Welcome back to the third and final episode of David Affley Ball by Polar and I. As always, I'm here with Lara Cross.
Hello.
Jordanaire, how are you?
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. So, done some delegating about the last two episodes.
Yeah.
And we started off, you know, first episode, early life, and kind of first kind of battles with depression. And second episode was really when the shit hit the fan, kind of hypersexuality, overspending, classic signs of bipolar, but at this stage, still not diagnosed, and I'm still not smart enough or self-aware enough to know about mental health conditions to even put two and two together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to survive. I'm just trying to make sure that I get through day to day by, you know, doing what I can to keep afloat. And it all comes to an end where I'm like, I can't do this anymore. You know, like I became this kind of womanizer character and that got found out. And it was just like, I've got nothing left. It's like I was exposed and bare and guilty and all these things. And I attempted to take my life at the train station. And I was stopped. And then I wasn't very well for the next couple of months still pretending I was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to take my life for a second time with an overdose. Luckily, I didn't, you know, succeed, or it didn't get into my blood. It didn't damage my organs,
mm-hmm.
which was very, very lucky for what I took, apparently. But one of the reasons I took that overdose is because I was trying to get help. At this stage, I had kind of done some research. My oldest sister has bipolar, and it kind of all kind of, after the first suicide attempt, it was a bit like, yeah, I think I've got that. But it was like, I can think I've got something for as long as I want.
Did someone tell you that in your family? Did someone say?
It was Gemma, my older sister, said, you know, you're showing a lot of signs of bipolar. And then I just did my own research. And I was like, yeah, this seems like this is it. But a GP can't, as we've been through this before, a GP can't diagnose bipolar. And the waiting list to see a psychiatrist on the NHS is very, very long. And I was waiting. I was back and forth to the GP, crying, trying different medications. I was on, a very weak mood stabilizer that the GP gave me, because they was like, yeah, we think it is too, but we can't actually give you anything stronger. Yeah.
What were you put on?
I can't remember, but it was a very kind of low range mood stabilizer. I remember that, and it wasn't really working. And again, with the first time, you know, when I came back from traveling and I went to the doctors and I was given antidepressants and they made me worse, I was getting to a point again where I felt there was no help.
Yeah.
And I was never going to see a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big factor in why I tried to take my life the second time as well. It was like, I want to get better, but I need more than an arm around the shoulder. I need some professional help. And when I overdosed and I was taken to the hospital, it was only then that I got to see a psychiatrist. And
what is that, like A&E?
I was taken to A&E, and then I think I was just bumped up the queue, and within a week I was seeing a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a diagnosis of bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
So two psychiatrists to get two opinions, because with bipolar, it's, you know, it's one of these things. It's kind of like you can't find it in your blood kind of thing. So it's like,
yeah.
And then I was,
and there are different types as well.
Yeah, there are different types. Type two, and it was a real tough time in my life, because I then got the diagnosis, and that made me feel like, okay, there might be some light at the end of this tunnel. And then they start giving you, the thing with bipolar is there's lots of different medications to treat it, but the crux of it is that usually you get a mood stabilizer partnered with an antidepressant, sometimes just a mood stabilizer.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of antidepressants, and there's lots of mood stabilizers.
Yeah.
So, like anything in the world, things agree and disagree with different people.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried me at first on sertraline, and quetiapine. And it really didn't agree with me. Both of them disagreed with me.
Mm-hmm.
I was still at this stage thinking, yeah, sex makes me feel good and being hypersexual. And I was on sertraline that is actually given to men that suffer from premature ejaculation. Now, I'm not bragging. Never been my thing. I'm a bragger, but I'm not bragging about this particular thing. I've never been a quick guy, right? Never been a two-minute man. And they put me on sertraline.
Take note, ladies.
Yeah. They put me on sertraline and it just stopped it completely. It just like put a plug, it tied the tubes. And it was like, I was still not happy at this stage. And I was still trying to find happiness in sex. And I always say, like, you think having sex with me would be bad enough. Try imagine having sex with me while I cry and fum in a semi. It didn't work out.
That's
right?
A lot. I do remember you, like, I remember talking to you around this time. And
yeah.
you were still like, you just were lost. And then you were trying to get help, but, you know, there is always a period of trying to find the right meds and it wasn't working
for
you.
It was really tough. Like that was the sertraline, you know, it stopped me from climaxing. But then the quetiapine was giving me restless leg syndrome. So I'd lay in a leg.
What a treat.
I'd be laying in bed like I was Chuck Berry, like all over the place, right? It was so mad. And then it gave me like blisters and ulcers and stuff all in my mouth,
mm-hmm.
and on my tongue, which was just horrible. So I wasn't having a good time. I was having a really bad time. I shouldn't have been drinking, and I was still drinking at this stage because mm-hmm. I wasn't getting a diagnosis is good and it's great. And it, like I said, there was some light at the end of the tunnel, but it was still a long fucking tunnel.
And also, just on that, so you said that, you know, what a diagnosis gave you was that light at the end of the tunnel, and perhaps, you know, hope that there was a solution. But was there anything that, when you got that diagnosis, was there anything that it sort of took away from you? Or did it make you feel worse at all?
I don't think it made me feel worse. I think, you know, the meds obviously didn't help with, you know, I had restless legs and sores in my mouth, and that didn't make me feel good about myself in terms of confidence.
Mm.
But I don't think the diagnosis ever made me feel worse, because it did give me something to hold on to.
And it's interesting that, because I think getting a diagnosis is often something people are really afraid of, and it's understandable. But quite often you find that when people get something, it's really validating.
Mm.
Really validating. And like, once you know what it is, you know how to treat it.
Yeah. And I think there was definitely an aspect to that. It became quite, like you said, validating. And you just, you know, I was watching lots of, there's a psychiatrist, Tracy Marks, and she does like online YouTube videos about different types of mental health. And she does a lot of videos on bipolar and different, you know, mania and hypersexuality and all that. And I really found a lot of comfort in her work.
Mm.
And it would be like my go-to thing. I would go and watch videos and just know that I'm not alone.
Yeah.
You know, I had a friend whose dad was bipolar, and I'd sometimes text, say, it's going to get better, it's going to get better. And she was like, yes, it's going to get better. Because it didn't feel like, you know, I had this diagnosis and I was still like I went down to London. I was trying to pretend that I was okay. I was meant to cover a boxing fight, and I went to the pub I used to work at, and, you know, it all kicked off, and I got arrested, and I'm not proud about that. And I mean, this brings you back into it, because I run away from the old Bill. I run away from the police and I call you. And crying, right? And then I get nicked. They come and find me. And obviously my phone gets turned off, and I was in the cell for 22 hours, and it was like the worst 22 hours of my life. It was horrible. Because I was...
Worst 22 hours of my life.
Yeah, and then...
No, I'm
because,
joking.
No, well, you
but
didn't know where I was.
The thing, yeah, and just to kind of outline, you know, our relationship at the time, I think quite soon on, we weren't, you know, we weren't in a romantic situation. We were just kind of, I was just supporting you from afar via phone calls.
It was like that, you know, you're looking back at you was really, it was like a really chucked, you know, baptism of fire in a way. Like, you know, you'd met this guy at the comedy club and, you know, you chat to him and we'd had a drink. And then it was like, after that, it was just like, I was like trying to, you know,
I was like your crisis worker.
He was like my crisis worker. And I will never forget that. And I'll always be grateful because I didn't have a crisis worker at this stage. I didn't have anyone like that. And he was really, he was really thrown into it, but you never really seemed to didn't seem to mind. But that time I called you and I was crying.
Well, I had all these I had missed calls from you. And obviously, you know, I knew what was going on with you at the time. And then I just can't get through to you. Just can't get through. And you're in London and like, I don't know your friends and family. I just thought he's killed himself. I remember I was sitting in the bath and I was just like, he's dead.
And that's a really horrible thought.
I messaged your sister on Facebook, got those detective skills out, found your sister. I was like, hun, what's going on? And she messaged back hours later and she was like, he's in prison.
He's in prison.
And I was like, fucking dick.
Yeah.
The law, yeah.
It was a really horrible time. I shouldn't have been drinking. I mean, in hindsight, like now I'm a completely different person and we'll get into that. And like, you know, but at the time I was like almost maybe looking for something. I don't know, like just looking for not trouble, but just looking for something to make me feel a bit like, I don't know. It was a really hard time. And you know, I learned from that. And because I was, I had been down as trying to commit suicide twice on the record. That they wouldn't allow me to be in the cell on my own. So I had a copper sitting with me every, and they changed every 6 hours. And they took my shoelaces away from me.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, just take your shoelaces away and you have someone sit. But I didn't mind because I got someone to chat to. Because it was 22 hours because they needed to find an appropriate adult for me because of my mental health condition. I wasn't allowed to do my own testimony. And, you know, listen, for the listeners that don't know, and I'm not going into details, but I got away. I got a caution, no criminal record. And you know, it was just a silly part of my life.
Bad boy for life.
Yeah, I was in a really, really, really bad week. I was so weak, like mentally. I just was broken at that stage. And it is what it is. And I'll always feel bad for, like, you sitting in the bar thinking I was dead. Because it's obviously not a very nice thought, but...
Well, I'm glad you're not.
Yeah, well, we're sitting here. And then after that, I go back to the psychiatrist. And we're trying different... I said, the quetiapine is not working. And I'm like, cool, can we try something else? And he's like, yeah, they want to try me on lithium. Now, lithium is what I'm currently on. And lithium is... quite a strong, powerful drug. To the point where when you're first on lithium, you have to get blood tests once a week. Because if lithium gets into your blood, it can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to monitor your blood. Now I'm down to being monitored once every 3 months. And I'm scared of needles. So that first lot was a lot. But I definitely, pretty soon after starting to take lithium, I definitely felt an improvement. I wasn't fully, really? Yeah, I definitely, it was like, okay.
What did you notice?
I noticed I was more stable. I was less hyper in terms of hypersexuality. That was less. I wasn't as low. I wasn't dancing around Sainsbury's as much. You know, none of these things. And it was like, okay, this is, and I felt quite good. But I was still struggling with depression because you know, the mood stabilizer can keep your mood as level. It can maybe stop these big spikes, lows and high spikes, but it can't, you know, nullify them completely. So that's why a lot of psychiatrists will partner a mood stabilizer with an antidepressant. But of course, sertraline really wasn't agreeing with me. And I didn't know what to do, and I was actually a bit embarrassed to say why sertraline wasn't agreeing with me.
Yeah, because to your doctor?
Well, every time I see my psychiatrist, they would there would be a young girl shadowing him, the trainee.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I ain't saying that.
Yeah,
I'm like, I can't, you know. I was like really embarrassed, so I just kept on, and it was probably bad because I needed it changed sooner.
Yeah.
You know, and then there was one time that I got to my doctor. Now, I'd be under the, like, team at the Pedder Centre in Norwich, and you get a psychiatrist, but then you get, like, somebody that works under the psychiatrist, like support worker, somebody that would check in with me, like, once every couple of weeks. We'd meet for coffee or, you know, and how are you doing, you know, and then, you know, kind of make sure if you felt like, oh, I need more meds, you would talk to them, they would talk to the psychiatrist.
Like a middleman.
Like a middleman. And it was, I had a girl and then she left and then I had a guy. And I had a girl doing that at the time. But I'm not talking about that. And every time I see my doctor, he's with the girl that's shadowing him. And I was so embarrassed. And it was like, probably held me back from my road to recovery just because of my male ego and my pride. But then I did tell him, eventually I did tell him, because she wasn't there. And I said, like, oh, Dr. Pandey, while we're together, I just need to say something. And I told him that. I was like, when I'm on sertraline, I can't climax. And then there was a knock on the door. There she comes, right? And I'm like, well, I don't care because I've said it now.
Yeah,
I've said what I've got to say. And then he goes, oh, hi. It was a different girl, another younger girl. And he was like, hey, this is David Ward. He's a comedian. He was just telling me that he struggles to ejaculate. Bro, that was between me and you. But the way he said it, like I was bragging. Like, do you know what? You know what, Doc? Lost long me.
It's funny. So like just you describing that there, because for you, it is such a personal thing in it and it would feel embarrassing. But for any healthcare professional, it's just clinical information.
Yeah.
So for people that do feel that embarrassment, you know, everyone does, but he just reported it in a clinical sense, because for him that was just like, okay,
yeah.
But it is, yeah, it's for the person who's saying it.
So after that we changed to mirtazapine,
mm-hmm.
which is another antidepressant, and I have been on the now lithium and mirtazapine every night before bed. And that's really when I was doing therapy as well at some stage.
How was that?
Yeah, it was gifted to me by my ex, and I will be always grateful for those sessions that I did get. And
what was the experience like of going to therapy? Because I think it's something that people are quite scared to do.
I think it was easier for me because I can talk. I'm a good talker.
No.
Yeah, no, I know I'm not come across that way, but I'm a good talker.
I
saw a guy, Joseph, and he was all right. We did some CBT therapy. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was good. It was just a nice way to. It was a nice way to be able to talk to somebody. I was in Norfolk. I didn't know many people at this stage here, so it was just nice to go off to somebody. And we didn't always, you know, the thing about therapy is it can be great and talking always helps, like, and it doesn't matter, like, people always say, oh yeah, you don't have to talk about what's going on with your mental health, you know.
Yeah,
you can just talk about whatever. You can just have someone to be like, oh, do you know what, I just baked a cake the other day and it, you know, I was really hopeful and then, you know, it collapsed in itself, you know.
I love that example,
you know, because you can talk to them about anything.
Yeah,
and talking is so vital in anybody's recovery from any kind of situation in terms of their mental well-being, you don't even have to talk about what's troubling you. But by talking about something else distracts your brain for a minute, you open up, you feel good about yourself, you're like, you know what, I'll do that cake better next time because I've learned from that.
And I think people are often maybe afraid that if they go into therapy they might end up having to talk about things that have happened in their past and things that have maybe been really difficult for them. And you also don't have to do that. Like, there are different types of therapy and there are lots of, you know, it can be quite confusing actually as how many types of therapies there are out there, but there are therapies that you can go to and talk about, like CBT therapy, and talk about more like the present day, like your thoughts, feelings, like how that then impacts your behaviors. Okay, like where can we introduce some change there? And it's not going back into this kind of deep, and you can do that if you want, but you don't have to.
Yeah.
So it's a service at the end of the day, and it provides, I mean, that's what I do. So.
Yeah. And I mean, you just talking to people, and it doesn't have to be a therapist as well. Like it just, it's been a big part of my recovery that I touched on it last episode, but you know, I see myself as pre and post suicide attempts.
Yeah.
And that second suicide attempt with the overdose was like, yes, it wasn't an overnight thing. But since then, I've got people in my life now that I didn't know then, that are my bubble and my support network, are my go-to. Because I think it's a very common misconception that the people that you know longest in the world are the people that will be there the most. And it's not the case. It just comes down to how nice people are and how much they love you. And you can know someone 5 minutes, they can love you more than somebody you know for 5 years. And I've known that now, like the circles I move in, completely different. And that's because I've been lucky enough through my journey to meet some wonderful, wonderful people. And, you know, I honestly, too many to name, but people that now in Norfolk, there's a guy that I know owned a gym when I first came up here, would train me for free. Every time I was down, train me for free.
Okay.
You know, because he believed in me and what I can offer the world. That's what he used to say. And so if what he can do is help me with an hour personal training session, we'd get the gloves, we'd spar each other. And that was great. And, you know, and then I've got you and Trudy and all the Fighting Cock boys and the Fighting Cock family and so many. I didn't want to do this. I didn't want to start naming people because, you know, there's ultimately going to be people I'm going to miss out.
You're not at the Oscars.
But it's about, my point here is just, it's about supporting, getting a good support network around you.
Definitely.
And like I said, it doesn't necessarily mean that the people that you know the longest will be the people that are there. And listen, I'm not saying that people, but some people, there is still a stigma of mental health. And I have some people that I've known a long time that I would sometimes call up crying or say that my mental health is really, and I can tell it makes them uncomfortable. And that's not them because they don't care about my mental health. They just don't know how to deal with the conversation. Yeah.
And I think just to draw a comparison here between the environment and the network that you were describing in like episode 1 and 2, where you were around, you know, people who would diminish the role of mental health, that would make you feel uncomfortable about it, that can have such a bad impact on someone's state of mind. Mm-hmm. So the fact that now you know you're not in that kind of environment is
like I'm very lucky, you know, that I travel a lot and for work, and I meet people that I travel with, and people take to me, you know. I know that sound big-headed or narcissistic or whatever, I don't care, they do. I've got friends all over the world that I can stay with. You know, every time I go to Holland, I stay with two mates that I met, you know, while away, and they're two, we were texting yesterday, like we're very good friends now. And I've been lucky that I've been able to build a support network of people that around me that love me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so vital. And it's been so vital to my road to recovery, because I wouldn't be the person that I am now without some of those people.
Yeah.
Without most of those people. You know, I wouldn't believe in myself the way that I do now without most of those people, because at the end of the day, I have bipolar. My brain is always telling me I'm not good enough. Always. Always. You're not good enough. You're, you know, kill yourself. All the time. And it's been a long road. I think after the lithium, it started to get better.
Yeah.
And then when we was on lithium and
metazepine,
that's when I really started to feel myself again. Shows were coming in. I was gigging all the time. I was up and down the country, all over Europe again. And I felt safe to do that.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't going away to do it. Do a show in Norway, for example, knowing that I was going there to chase the night, knowing that you know, I was going there because I was good at my craft and I wanted to make people laugh.
Yeah.
And it's just a mentality shift. It's just, and I started to grow more and more confident, and now, you know, a lot has happened to me in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
You know,
a lot. Talk us through it.
Well, I've always been a stand-up, and, you know, I've always think I was pretty good at stand-up, but then, like, I've just started to get more recognised, I think, for my talent, in a way. I've done, a TV producer come to see me mm-hmm. at Top Secret Comedy Club, and then she called me and she was like, can you warm up for the Mo Gilligan show for Channel 4
mm-hmm.
tomorrow?
Sick.
And I was like, yeah, I can. So then I go and warm up for the Mo Gilligan show for Channel 4.
I'm washing my hair,
like, you're hanging out with, like, Dermot O'Leary and the late Caroline Flack and Mo Gilligan, obviously, and all these people. There was an after party sponsored by Lynx, and I'm like, this is just mad. And then I did really well, and I was like, can you come and do a pilot we're making with the Redknapps?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, of course. I was like, you love football, you'd be great for it.
Mm.
And so I then started doing this warm-up. I did a warm-up for the pilot of the Redknapps show, which actually got cancelled because of COVID, and it's back now without an audience. But I did the pilot, and I was like getting drunk with Jamie Redknapp and Harry Redknapp and Chris Kamara and Stephen Graham and Mel B. I went up to Mel B and I went, you're all right for a Spice Girl? She goes, have you met many of us? I went, no. Just the first. And she was like doing the most Mel B thing ever. She was like in a leopard print onesie. Yeah. Drinking wine out of a plastic cup. And it was like...
Do you think that's really her? Or do you think she's just like...
Well, this was backstage.
Yeah, probably.
This was like... So it was all like backstage now. And, you know, I did the stand-up sketch show. I hosted the stand-up sketch show for ITV2.
Yeah.
Because I saw the producer in a pub and I went up to him and went, you produced the stand-up sketch show. And he goes, I know who you are. You're David Alfie Ward.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah. He goes, I've seen some of your comedy videos. I did some stuff with Paul Chowdhury. And then he was like, oh, I'll get you on the show. And then he called me up and he was like, oh, I want you to come in and host it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is mid-2020, mid-pandemic.
Yeah.
And I hosted the stand-up sketch show and with Ian Sterling, the voice of Love Island, massaging my shoulders, telling me my jokes in my ear. The voice of Love Island is telling me my jokes that he liked. He's relaying my jokes to me, and I'm like, this is the voice of Love Island.
That's kind of hot.
I was a bit aroused.
Yeah.
And then we all went and got drunk in the Wetherspoons together afterwards. And it's like, I'm with all these famous comics, and we're just drinking Prosecco from a pint glass, like a plastic pint
And
glass.
Who would have thought you would have been there way back when?
I didn't, 18 months ago, I didn't want to live.
Yeah.
2 years before. And of course, like, a lot has happened with the pandemic with your mental health. Like, I always said, you know, the pandemic hit and I was like, it made me yo-yo more than ever. I think it's very, but when you tell people you got bipolar, people don't really understand. And it's a part of the reason we're doing this podcast, because people don't really understand bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's schizophrenia. They think you hear voices, or you got split personalities, stuff like that. Or they think that you are literally up and down like a yo-yo.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily what bipolar is.
Mm-hmm.
Bipolar is, you can have, you know, some people have months of highs and months of lows. I usually go weeks or days.
Yeah.
And
this is the difference between as well, the different types of bipolar.
Yeah, of course. But the pandemic made me more yo-yo-y than ever, because it was just uncertainty.
Yeah.
You know, I had that, I did the Redknapp thing, and then, you know, the producer pulled me aside and he was like, I think, we're going to get the series. And I was like, I'm going to meet all these footballers. And and then the pandemic said no live audiences. Comedy clubs are closed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I remember that.
And it just, so my, I was yo-yoing. Like, there was just the uncertainty, just like couldn't see anybody. I was isolated in kind of North Norfolk.
Yeah.
And I just didn't know how to cope. And I said to you, I think it's making me relapse. I think it's making me go back to what I was 18 months ago, 2 years ago. And you actually said to me, don't be stupid. Like,
did I say stupid?
Well, I don't know if that's the word, but
I think I remember. And I was saying to you, actually, you're not where you were, because if this had happened to you 2 years ago, you'd be dead. Like, if everything had been cut off, all of your like livelihood, yeah, you have come so far in the stability around your mental health. It's like, it's night and day.
And
there's differences as well between like a lapse and a relapse. Yeah. So like a lapse being kind of a small blip where you notice some of those warning signs, you actually do a little bit then to say, okay, what can I do to get on top of it? Like, what helps me? How can I get like more stable again? Versus a relapse, which is where actually, you know, you've tried those things, you've tried to help yourself, it's not really working, you need to get some more support. But there's a difference.
Like you said, if the pandemic had hit back then, I would have probably killed myself. And instead, I knew that people would be struggling, so I started something called David's Coffee Club.
What's that?
David's Coffee Club. I was doing virtual coffee meets to anybody that needed them.
Yeah.
Where we'd both sit down over video call with a coffee and just chat like you were in a coffee shop, having a coffee, have a chat, half an hour, and that's it. And I did that, and I had people, strangers, call me in Australia.
Yeah.
And then
that's amazing.
Yeah, it was a really, and towards the end of David's Coffee Club, it became as very beneficial to me as well as it did to other people, that just, you know, I'd make them laugh and I would make them, you know,
yeah,
didn't seem so bad. And then I got approached by Mind to become an ambassador.
Mm.
So I became an ambassador to Mind, and I was the face of a campaign. And like, you know, all this stuff wouldn't have happened if I had been successful in those suicide attempts.
Yeah.
My life now is so much better, and I'm so happy, and I'm being recognized. I've just been headhunted for a big pub brands Euro podcast.
Mm.
And none of this, like even just going back to football, I watched my team in 2019 get to a European Cup final.
Mm.
Something that I know that to anyone that's listening that doesn't like football or, you know, love it like I do, they probably think, oh yeah, but to me, I never would have dreamed that I would have seen. And I was there in Amsterdam. I did a show. Because I know the owner of the comedy club, I did a show in the day to traveling Tottenham supporters. We sold it out, packed out the comedy club. Me and another Spurs supporter comedian did half an hour each. Yeah. And then we just went off and we got drunk, and I was with Flav and I was with Kayvon. And these are wonderful, wonderful people. And Kayvon is very, very special to me. We just watched it, and we watched Tottenham score 3 goals in 45 minutes to go to the European Cup final. And I went to the European Cup final in Madrid. I got a ticket. I took my uncle that lives in Ireland, my mum's brother, and I had to work for BT Sport out there. No, that was in Amsterdam, and then I worked for BBC in Madrid. Okay, I don't remember the game because we were drinking from like 8 a.m. and we were dehydrated and very drunk. And I know we lost. And I know it was an awful game, and I'll never watch that back in my life, right? Mm. I'll never ever watch it. But those memories that are in my head now, the semi-final, mm-hmm. the being in the European Cup final with people, you know, around people that you utterly adore, that you've been going to Tottenham with a long, long time, I would have been dead. I would have been, maybe if I was lucky, one of them would have brought a cardboard cut out of me. As a memorial. No, that, do you know what I mean?
And also, but if someone had said to you back when you were suicidal, this is going to happen for you one day, what would you have told them?
I wouldn't have believed it. Like, all this stuff.
The reason I say that is for people who are where they are now, if you feel in any type of way like that, your brain is lying to you. Your brain is like at the moment, it's just like a toxic, festering little pile of whatever, and it tells you things that you fully in your mind and your body you believe there's no hope. But even this example here with David, it wasn't true.
No,
like
it wasn't.
What
no,
you believed at the time was not true, like went on to live those things.
But I definitely believed it.
You do.
You do because I've got a whiteboard in my bedroom, and I used to have a saying on it, your brain is lying. And it's on the back of my door. So every time I'd leave, I would know my brain. And it's just Just mad.
And the reason being that your brain is sick, you're unwell. Like that's the difference. And I think we don't talk enough about how, you know, we are not our thoughts. Like they are being produced by an organ, by our brain, and as it can be well and we can have happy and good thoughts, it can be unwell and it can produce really unhelpful thoughts about yourself, about the world, about your future. And it's, you know, if you need someone else to help you point that out, then that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes when your brain is lying, you need, it's almost like you're drunk, right? And you're drunk and you've had a few too many pints at the pub, but you're driving and you're like, fuck. And then you just, sometimes you need your sober mate to be like, I'll drive.
Mm.
I'll direct you right now because you aren't in a state to direct yourself.
Mm.
And that's what it's like. Sometimes you just need to ask people, you know, am I worthless? And whatever your brain is telling you, ask somebody, because people love you. No matter who you are, people love you. And there's always...
Call the Samaritans.
Call the Samaritans.
They love everyone.
Call Mind. Call David's Coffee Club if you have to, but I'm no professional. I'll just probably get my nipple out if I'm hyper. I'm going through a hypermania. But, you know, it's fine.
And it's like seeking help doesn't mean that you're weak. It actually means that you can recognize that you're struggling. Yeah. And to say to someone, I am struggling, for me, there is nothing braver than that statement. Like, to actually say that to someone, and it's not a weakness.
And things will always get better. Look, like, when we said in the first episode that when I left school, I wanted to be an actor. I became a comedian. But then 2020, I was alive and someone was like, you're perfect to act. And I've made my professional acting debut in a short film I made in Paris. And it's just all these things. The more I think about how mental my life has been in the last 2 years, the more I'm like, I was so easily, you know, a memorial. Yeah. I was so close to doing that. And I'm just, you know, take what you want from this podcast, but I'm like, I like to think that I'd be proof that it is going to get better. Better times will come. And it, you know, no matter what your brain is telling you, it will get better because, you know, it always will. It will.
Mm. And we wanted to talk a little bit as well about kind of, you know, preventing setbacks or also knowing how to manage them when they do come up. And I think it's helpful for people who have been through, you know, mental health difficulties, struggles, to know, you know, what are my warning signs? What should I look out for? Checking in with yourself, is that weekly, monthly? Like, where am I at? And, you know, for you, like, where are you at with that? Like, what are your warning signs, or how would you sort of work if there was a setback?
Listen, I have setbacks. Of course I do. I have bipolar. It's never going to be rosy all the time. But again, I think it is. I know that I can call people now. And yeah. I never knew that I could call people then. And I know I've got people that literally, when they say, you know, you can call me anytime, no matter what time, they mean it.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky to have that. So I can identify it coming. You know, if I wake up, I'm fatigued, I'll always struggle with that fatigue.
Yeah,
you know, it is hard. And it's simple as stuff like I'll brush my teeth, because if I wake up and I'm in a low and I'm depressed, if it's gone past lunchtime and I still haven't brushed my teeth, the day's written off for me. And that might sound a little silly, but just the brushing your teeth in the morning when you get out of bed, you know, before your tea or after your tea, whatever, you have your cuppa, brush your teeth, my brain can go, you can start your day now.
Yeah.
Because that's starting your day, right? You don't leave the house before you brush your teeth in the morning.
Mm.
But if I'm still with my hood up, watching TV with a blanket on the sofa and I haven't brushed my teeth, then what's the fuck? No, it's, you know, 1 PM now. You might as well just stay on the sofa all day. You know, and it's knowing your triggers and knowing how to kind of combat those triggers.
Exactly, yeah. And is there, you know, as well, so you've come such a long way in like career, getting your mental health stabilized, helping other people as well. Is there any areas where like you still feel you want to work on, you still feel like you're held back a bit?
I struggle to love.
Yeah.
I really do. And that's something I really don't want, because I'm quite a loving person. You know, I'm quite soppy. I'm a crier. I cry at films, and more than ever, since my suicide attempts, and when I was pushing all my emotions down and then they all came out and I was crying and trying to kill myself. Now I'm like, my future wife needs to know that I watched The Mighty Ducks Reunion the other day and I cried. I'm like, I need a woman that's just going to be like, yeah, I love David, but sometimes he cries at Coronation Street. You know, it's like,
your emotions are like easily accessible.
They are so hot. It's like, you know, those prank nuts and a springy snake comes out. I can't put that shit back. And I'm trying. And,
Hun, we love you for it. You don't need to try.
But I've been in love twice since my relationship broke down.
You never told me that you loved me before.
And the first one, call her Strawberry. And
you know who you are. It's not me, guys.
It was mental. It was like I've never felt like that for somebody so quickly.
Yeah.
It was like, cliche to say, love at first sight, but it was something like a connection that was very, very special. And she lived up north, and I was doing shows there, and it was just meant to be like this weekend. I do shows, you come to my show, and we go out drinking and stuff. And I then spent a lot of time up north. I took any little show I could in that region. And it was very, very special. It was wild, like just the chemistry and the connection is mental. And then we were sitting down in a pub one time, and she was like, you know, the next guy I'm going to be with, like, you know, we're hitting 30 now, the guy I want kids with.
Mm-hmm.
And there I was, presented with the same question, do you want kids, that I was with my ex-fiance. And my brain just gave the same answer. It just gave the same answer. It just said, nope, don't want kids. Don't want kids. And I just completely, and I doubled down, and I completely kind of, nope, don't want kids. Don't want kids. Nope, obviously we're not going to work out, are we? You know, it's not what we thought it was. Because of the fear. Because it was still there a little bit. But also, I never really had time to sit back and realize. It was like muscle memory. You know, it was like, there's a question. I know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
And then she was like, well, obviously tonight we was away somewhere. We had a hotel. She was like, we'll be our last night. And I was like, yeah, obviously. Cool. I was like doubling down like a fucking idiot. Like, yeah, obviously. And then I remember she left me in the morning. She was crying. I've never seen anybody cry when they left me. I was like, I'll never forget it. Like,
sounds like you really
yeah. And but like me being stupid and naive and stuff like that, you know. But you know, now I know, because of that, I know the answer to that question. I do want kids. I think I'd be a very good dad. You know, I'd let my kid be whatever they want to be, but Arsenal. And or Chelsea, actually.
What if they just didn't like football?
That's fine. That is fine.
Really?
But if they liked football and they wanted Arsenal or Chelsea, that is not fine. Do you know what I mean? But I know the answer to that question now, and maybe that was the reason for such an amazing connection, and I'll never forget what we had. It was amazing. And then I fell in love again about a year later. Again with another Northerner. It used to be me and those Northerners. Yeah. And that was different. It was like born out of lockdown. So my last show I did before lockdown was in Sheffield. No, it was Derbyshire, sorry. Match with this girl. We'll call her Henderson's. And then it was like, I was driving back when I matched back to Norfolk. And I was like, you're in Sheffield. I'm not going to, I'm not going to, like, you know, chat to you because you live so far away. And then lockdown happened. It's like, it doesn't matter where everybody lives.
Yeah.
And we just started chatting, and we got on with the chat was flowing well. And she was like, you know, when we could start meeting again, she's like, do you want to meet? And I was like, yeah, fine. And then I spent like the majority of last summer, 2020 summer there in Sheffield, staying with her once she could do that. And that was very special. But then it was just like, I fell in love, and I think the relationship would have been flawed because it was born out of lockdown. Like, I wasn't gigging at weekends. I was always free and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I was terrified of what I was feeling. Just like with the first girl, I was scared of what I was feeling. I was presented with that question and I gave the answer. And I probably gave the answer as abruptly as I did because I was scared of what I was feeling as well. Because I'm scared of love because I've only was in love once before these two.
Mm.
And that ended how it was. And I was a piece of shit and all that. And
so it's interesting because say to me on the phone, like, I will never ever be able to fall in love.
Yeah.
I will never find anyone, you know, it's not for me, it's not possible. And then again,
because I think,
you know,
yeah.
you did and you are able, but I think you are still at that point where you think that you can't.
I used to be, I'm always very honest with women now as well. Like, you know, I can't lie because, you know, I just don't want to. And I will always say if I'm going on a date with a girl and I dated somebody in 2019, she came and met my mum and stuff like, but it was never like we were friends before and it was like a fling. And I would always say like, we can have a good time. I'm good. You know, I'm good company and funny and stuff like that, but don't fall in love with me because I'm not that person. I can't love. I'm broken. I used to say that flat bang to rights. I'm broken. Right, I can't love. Like what I said to you, I can't love. And they never used to get scared. And it kind of comes back to my friend Darren Harriet. Big shout out. He's like doing really well for himself. I love him to bits. And he said to me once, he can't swim. And he said, like, whenever he's on a date and it comes up that he can't swim, he sees the pure delight in the girl's face. Because they're like, I'll be the one to teach you. Because I think it's in a female's nature to want to nurture. To want to, you know. So I think when I said to Henderson's, I'm broken.
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, you're broken to those girls, but I'll be the one to fix you because women want to nurture, they want to love, they want to prove that you can do that. And in a way, she did do that. I'll give her a due. Like, it didn't work out how it was. It kind of got a bit messy at the end. In terms of just, you know, like we're not in touch, which is, you know, hurts me. I wish we were, but she did fix me because now with these last two girls, Strawberries and Henderson's, I know that I want kids and I know that I can love. And I know once I find that special connection
mm-hmm.
that I'm all in, chips on the table.
Mm.
You know, and it will be hard for women to trust me. And I get that. I'm putting my whole... you know, exposing myself all on a podcast that hopefully help others come, you know, help them. People listen to this that might know somebody that you can get them help. But it's going to be, you know, but I'm ready to love, but I also am a bit scared of it.
Of course. If you've been burnt by something before, you're going to have that fear there. And as I say, I think it's
yeah.
You've come a long way even with that difficulty. And it's really nice to see. And you say, oh, you know, it'll be difficult for women to trust me and think the right person, that's not going to be an issue with them.
Mm.
And actually your heart is so good.
Yeah.
So good. It's so pure. You're so caring. And yeah, it is just nice to see.
I'm not going to jump in a relationship with the first person that comes along because, you know, I'm not saying that it's impossible, but I think it's very
Rihanna
rare.
Comes along?
I wouldn't jump in a relationship, but I'll take her for some fish and chips on the coast.
Nice.
Yeah. And yeah, I'm not going to jump in because I think sometimes, you know, so I can't talk for everybody, but I think it's rarer if you don't really. In a way, with Strawberry, it's kind of like I know now there is such thing as these amazing kind of connections in an instant.
Yeah.
And I'll be probably looking for that. You know, but then with Henderson's, it was a longer process, but I fell in love with her too. She was great. And, you know, the time we spent together, I will cherish because it was nice. And I just now, I want something more long term. And, you know, I want to settle down, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and, yes, I have a job where I go around, I do these comedy clubs and girls will want to chat to me in pubs and stuff like that. And that's okay, but it doesn't mean that that's what I'm going to do. I'll take pictures. And yeah, if you want a picture, thanks for coming to the show. Da, da, da. But it's not just girls that do that. Guys do that too. Guys more come up and go, you were funny, you want a pint? Yeah, all right.
So I guess in terms of this podcast, really, so we've obviously gone through kind of your journey, your childhood, when you first started feeling low, you know, how actual long it took you to get that diagnosis. That's a long, that's a long time. And what is it that you would want to say to someone now who, actually, let's do like, what would you want to say to yourself back then?
That it, you know, and I said it before, that it will get better. I know what you're feeling now. You're very confused, and you're angry at yourself, or you're upset. And I can, like I said, when I saw that kettle and it brought me back to there, I can put myself back into that place. And you just feel lost, and that feeling of dread that I touched upon, you know, when you lose your phone, it's all that, but it will go away. It will go away. And yes, listen, I probably always will have a little regret, and I know you told me not to use this word off air. You was like, stop using the word regret. But there will always be a regret for what I did and how I behaved, you know, and not getting the right help at the time of being, you know, with my ex. But I did genuinely try. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know I went to the doctors and but it's that feeling of despair. I would tell my past self that will go away, and you will get help. You will find amazing people in your life that you don't even know exist right now, and you will be very happy. Yeah, and I think that brings it to an end. That was thank you all for listening. We really, really appreciate your ears. Obviously, if you have enjoyed it, you know, rate the podcast, share it with a friend, family, you know, loved one on your social media. Let's try and get this conversation out there so that people out there with undiagnosed bipolar, undiagnosed mental health conditions might listen to it, might get help, might know what's wrong with them. And if we can help one person, then we've done enough. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to David Alfie Ward, Bipolar and I, a Cabin Fever original podcast.